The story behind the headlines. Every Sunday evening at this time, the National Broadcasting Company, in cooperation with the American Historical Association, presents Caesar Searchinger in his analysis of the news. In this analysis, Mr. Searchinger draws upon research material especially prepared for these broadcasts by eminent historians. And now, Caesar Searchinger.
Good evening, everybody. As summer wanes, our eyes are again on Europe, on the sharpening economic crisis and the struggle between East and West. Prominently in the news are two countries on either side of the so-called Iron Curtain, Hungary and Greece. In Hungary, national elections have been held in which the communists reached the top of the poll, though not with the numbers which might have been expected since they had the all-out support of the Russian occupation force. The previously dominant Small Landholders Party has been reduced to a quarter of its former strength, but still ranks second after a fusion effected today, and the socialists rank fourth. The communists, with a gain of only 27 seats, now hold 97 out of a total of 411. However, they are the dominant element in the government coalition consisting of the communist, smallholders, socialist, and national peasant parties. But all is not well within the government coalition, which will be headed by a communist premier, Matyas Urakoshi. The socialists, charging that 185,000 of their party members have been disfranchised, mostly without notice, have threatened to bolt the coalition. It is charged that there have been wholesale election frauds, and there is a great deal of post-election recrimination. A very active part in the argument is being taken by General V.P. Zviridov, the Soviet commander and chairman of the Allied Control Council. General Zviridov, it seems, sent for the leader of the socialists and smallholders' parties to persuade them to stay in the government. Both will probably find it advisable. In any case, they will certainly not give up the key post of Minister of the Interior, I mean the communists, the man who holds the police, and who came in so handy during the recent communist coup. That coup, you may remember, resulted in the purge of the largest party, the smallholders, on grounds of attempted treason, and in the flight of Premier Ferenc Nagy, now in this country. Yet it is remarkable that even after all that has happened, in the way of terror, intimidation, arrests, and violence, the healthy core of the Socialist Party has openly shown signs of revolt. Moreover, Hungary is traditionally a peasant country and strongly Catholic. The Catholic influence continues to be strong. It is now represented by the Democratic People's Party, which captured 58 seats, running just behind the communists. Hungary is of strategic importance to Soviet Russia as a satellite. Together with the other Balkan satellites, it now gives the Soviet bloc control of both sides of the Danube, from Austria to the Black Sea. Just before the Hungarian elections, the Soviet government ratified the peace treaties with these satellites and, incidentally, with Italy. Gratitude for this belated action may have helped the Communist Party, but the effect was rather less than might have been expected. Turning to the other side of the curtain, the Iron Curtain, there has also been political trouble in Greece. Greece is the particular object of American solicitude, under the so-called Truman Doctrine of containing Russia by providing counterforce at strategic points. Well, the extremely rightist Maximus cabinet fell 2 weeks ago after its three moderate members, including the younger Venizelos, resigned. Foreign Minister Tsaldaris, a recent visitor to Washington, was the government's real boss and a real reactionary royalist. But the most objectionable member was Napoleon Zervas, a former pro-Nazi who had charge of national security and combating the rebel guerrillas of the North. Zervas was dropped under pressure from the United States. What our representatives in Greece wanted is a more broadly based government with liberals in it, which would be acceptable to American opinion. For after all, we are staking Greece to $300 million and maybe more. So King Paul asked Tsaldaris to form a new government. And since no liberal would serve under him, he came up with an all-royalist slate. This our representatives would not stand for, and they made it clear that American aid might not continue unless. The situation was so critical that the State Department sent Loy W. Henderson, its Middle East chief, to straighten it out. Finally, Tsaldaris had to yield by permitting the aged Liberal Party chief, Themistocles Sophoulis, to head a new two-party cabinet in which the royalists, misnamed populists, still have the majority. For they are, after all, the parliamentary majority. But this was the result of a crisis election in 1946 and does not represent the whole Greek people as of today. It would be rash to consider the new Greek cabinet liberal. It is simply a little less unrepresentative than its predecessor. That's all. Above all, it is a government sanctioned by the United States, just as the communist-dominated government of Hungary is sanctioned by Soviet Russia. Both countries are in the position of client states in this divided world of today. Both are of strategic importance to their patron powers. Greece and Turkey are nearest available bases for the protection of the Middle East, where American oil properties are rapidly becoming a vital national interest. Arrangements were completed only last week for the building of the world's most capacious pipeline from Saudi Arabia to the coast of Lebanon, which is next door to Turkey and not far from the ports of Greece. In fact, it is on the colonial coast of ancient Hellas, an economic factor in the Hellenic Empire over 2,000 years ago. Whether we shall eventually send American forces to Greece still remains to be seen. For the present, we have merely persuaded the British not to withdraw their remaining 3,000 soldiers or so. Greece and Hungary are symbols of the political division of Europe and also of the economic plight of Europe, divided into potentially rich agrarian countries like Hungary and countries which depend for their survival on foreign trade. Since Western Europe is separated from its complementary East, its rehabilitation is far more difficult, and its dependence on America almost complete. Therefore, the Western European crisis expresses itself, in the immediate view, simply as a dollar shortage, though in the long view, it is much more than that. Looking at it as a purely financial problem, Foreign Secretary Ernest Bevin startled the world a few days ago by gently hinting that we, the United States, redistribute the gold hoard stored away in Fort Knox. I shall not attempt to explain just what he meant. More competent authorities have failed, and London's Financial Times has called it sheer nonsense. The gold, Bevin figured, isn't doing anybody any good where it is. So he seems to think that we could just earmark it for the European countries, who would then buy all the food and materials they want. But how would this differ essentially from the loans contemplated under the Marshall Plan, which, by the way, is estimated to cost a minimum of $21 billion, according to the schedule set up by the 16-nation conference in Paris. In either case, the money, or the gold, would flow back to America, since virtually all the food and materials needed will have to be bought from us. It is, of course, possible that Mr. Bevin had in mind some way of stabilizing European currencies with our gold. But that would have to follow economic rehabilitation, for it would probably result in ruinous inflation unless Europe had actual values, production, to back up the currency. Gold backing nowadays does not alone determine the value of a nation's currency, not even our own. But it is interesting to see a British statesman, and a socialist at that, suggest the use of gold to bolster Europe's economies. It was the British who led the world in establishing gold as the single monetary standard in 1816, and it was the British who said that the gold standard had failed after they went off gold in 1931. The acceptance of the gold standard throughout the world greatly facilitated the free flow of world trade, and it was the British who prospered most through world trade before World War I. All through the 19th century, Britain was the greatest creditor nation and the world's banker. She lost that position in the First World War when the United States furnished most of the supplies and in consequence became an even greater creditor than Britain had been. But since we continued to export far more than we imported after the war, and since therefore a large part of the goods had to be paid for in gold, most of the world's gold flowed to the United States. American gold holdings increased from less than $2 billion in 1915 to almost $20 billion in 1940. Today, our gold accumulation is close to $22 billion, of which 12 are deposited in the great vaults at Fort Knox. And the flow of gold is bound to continue so long as we are willing to pay $35 an ounce for it, and possibly more. In these circumstances, the British said the gold standard no longer made any sense. Its international function in the old days was to balance the accounts between any two nations if one had exported more than the other over a given period. Usually, only a modest amount of bullion sufficed to even things up and keep the currencies at par. Internally, gold was used to provide cover and a standard of value of the national currency. But that, too, was abandoned when countries, impoverished by the war, printed paper money indiscriminately to provide cash with which to pay inflated prices. The flow of gold to America further helped to weaken Europe's currencies. For years, their largely fictitious value has been fixed by law and hedged about with restrictions. Nearly all of them have ceased to become freely interchangeable. Meantime, as Lord Keynes said, gold has failed, both as a means of payment and as a standard of value. Yet, a leading British finance minister today advocates restarting world trade by a transfusion of gold. What Europe needs today is not gold, but goods. Goods produced in the countries now prostrate and poor. And that is precisely what the Marshall Plan would aim to accomplish. Activate the energies of the countries which once provided 30% of all the exports in the world. And speaking of the Marshall Plan, Washington officially expects President Truman to call Congress in special session in December, and maybe before. This decision is the result of some frantic messages from Undersecretary Clayton and other high U.S. officials now in Europe. The story is that Western Europe is racing toward complete economic collapse, and something must be done to fill the gap between the last dollar and the actual beginning of the plan. The estimated stopgap price is $2.5 billion on the barrel head. Will Congress grant it? Will it go along quietly, or must it be terrified into action by more vivid visions of chaos suffused with red? What is more, will Congress, economy-minded and tax-conscious in an election year, go along with the whole Marshall Plan, with its $21 billion reduced from 30 over 4 years? But the immediate fear in the minds of informed people is not whether the Marshall Plan will be accepted, but whether it will not come too late. 4 months ago, after the Moscow conference, Secretary Marshall said that the patient is sinking while the doctors debate. The sinking of the patient has been accelerated by a number of things, and one of them is the rising spiral of prices here in the United States. With one hand, we have been handing out stopgap loans, while with the other, we have been depressing the buying power of those very loans. And when the Marshall Plan is finally granted, Europeans will say, it will be to save our own economic skins, not for the sake of Europeans. For when Americans can no longer pay the inflated prices, foreigners will be expected to pay them with money we lend them without any hope of return. Europe apparently is willing to go a long way to increase production, to stabilize currencies, to move towards economic union. But, says the forthcoming report of the 16 European nations now assembled in Paris, Europe cannot regain a healthy balance unless it can sell its products in America to earn the dollars it must borrow today. Unless we in this country think in such common sense, long-range terms, the history of the 30s may be repeated with prospects of utter chaos and possibly war. Good night.
The National Broadcasting Company and its affiliated independent stations, in cooperation with the American Historical Association, have presented Caesar Searchinger. Next week at this time, Mr. Searchinger will be back with another story behind the headlines. This is NBC, the National Broadcasting Company.